less severe, perhaps 10 to 20%, so a modest reduction.
If you're a person who has no immunity at all, no vaccination, and no prior infection, or your prior infection was a year and a half ago and it was mild, you're not out of the woods. I mean, there is a reasonable chance that you will get very sick with Omicron.
So people who don't have the protection of vaccination still have to worry here.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, many hospitals in general are already overburdened. They're short-staffed. So even a smaller surge in hospitalizations could be crippling for hospitals. And the government called off that campaign because of data showing that hospitalization rates with Omicron are likely lower. And there's some concern among scientists that too many booster shots too quickly may backfire and cause the immune system to sort of go to sleep or start ignoring SARS-CoV-2.
Good reason to proceed cautiously. Michaeline, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Michaeline Duclef. And we're joined now by President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I've been staring at charts of COVID cases for individual cities, and maybe I have a self-interest in this since I'm in Washington, which is one of the worst, if not the very worst. In some places, the chart, there's a straight line upward off the chart. So how high does this go?
You know, Steve, it's very difficult to predict. As you saw just a bit, peak that we had literally this winter, it's very difficult to tell. Clearly, we're on a vertical climb right up. Hopefully, this will peak and turn around. What we've seen in other countries like South Africa, we were on a Zoom call just a day ago with our South African colleagues, and they had the same sort of sharp spike up, almost vertically up. They're starting to see a turnaround now where the cases are coming down, perhaps due to saturation in the sense you've hit all the vulnerable. There will be breakthrough infections with vaccinated and even boosted people. But as you just mentioned in the interview prior to this, that there seems to be less of a severity, particularly for those who have been vaccinated and have a breakthrough infection, that it really is less severe. So we're hoping that the less severity will get us through this without having a surge on the hospital system. But it's the unvaccinated that we're really very concerned about. They're really quite vulnerable.
A couple of things to follow up on there. First, there are parts of the country where it's not a vertical spike going straight up, where cases have remained relatively steady or only gone up a little bit.
Let your guard down and feel that because in your region you're not seeing a high spike. This is an extraordinarily efficient virus in spreading from person to person. It is just something like we've never seen before. The cases in any place you go, when the virus gets in there, it goes way up. So for those who have not had a severe impact yet, please continue to be prudent about wearing masks. And if you're not vaccinated, get vaccinated. And if you're vaccinated, please go get boosted. Boosting makes a major difference with Omicron. We've shown that several times now in different countries. Boosting makes a big difference.
What is your assessment of what we heard in the earlier report about the possibility that too much boosting could backfire, that perhaps a fourth shot is something to shy away from?
Well, I think what they were referring to is that when you get the benefit of a boost, it's to allow the immune system in the interval between one injection and another to give it a chance to what we call get affinity maturation. In other words, to rev itself up to be optimally responsible to the next boost. If you boost too often and too frequently, you don't give the immune system the chance to get that maturity, which we call it, which means it develops a greater breadth and a greater strength. So right now, we should just do the boosters, and then we'll worry about the next boost if we need it. But right now, get the first boost. That's the most important thing. Don't worry about a fourth boost. We'll worry about that later and maybe never have to worry about it.
What do you think about this, the plight of many Americans who have wanted to find a test or a bunch of tests for their family over the past week, and they have great difficulty finding it, can't find it at all? I know the administration has promised 500 million tests, but they're not going to be available today. They're not going to be available.
Much, much greater escalation of the availability of testing. But you're right. We have to admit it. Right now, there have been lines. I've seen lines myself right in my own city. Here in New York City, there have been lines. It's something that is unfortunate, but we just have to do the best that we can until we get the relief of a lot more tests coming in January.
I'd like to hear your assessment of another thing that some officials are doing in this crisis. In New York State, they have said that public health workers who need to quarantine can do it for just 5 days instead of 10. And that is partly an effort to mitigate the lack of essential health workers. Is 5 days enough?
I believe it will be, Steve, and I think that's something that we're going to be considering beyond New York City. You need the healthcare workers, and when you have them out for the full 10 days, and you do that over a wide swath of people, you can have a situation where you really do not have enough healthcare workers, and that's the reason why New York City made that choice, and I think we'll get infected.
Is five just very briefly enough?
And make sure we get them back to their essential jobs.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
He's President Biden's chief medical advisor.
Sarah Weddington has died. Her career as a lawyer included one of the most famous court cases of the past half century. Weddington was 26, fresh out of law school, when she helped to represent a woman known as Jane Roe.
That was the pseudonym for Norma McCorvey, who asserted her right to an abortion in Roe versus Wade.
Let's see.
Weddington died yesterday at her home in Texas at 76. The news arrives as the Supreme Court considers a challenge to that famous ruling.
A few years ago, Weddington told NPR that a conservative majority of justices on the high court could arrive at a new conclusion, and she speculated on what the justices might say.
The language is not in the Constitution, and so it doesn't really exist. It was made up by the justices at the time to legislate in whatever way they want to.
And Weddington said if that precedent is reversed, the implications are wider.
Privacy is not meant to be a one-state deal. It's meant to be the basis for people living in all the United States.
Weddington's last public stand for abortion rights was 2 years ago.
She attended the signing ceremony for a New York law that is designed to safeguard abortion rights if Roe versus Wade is overturned.
College students bring you their Christmas festival. Wisconsin's best young musicians perform in the annual honors concerts. And Ruth Ann Bestman plays your holiday favorites on Classics by Request. Enjoy these festive programs now through the new year on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College, where student success is priority. With more than 70 career programs, students graduate prepared for the career of their dreams with expert instructors, hands-on training, and dedicated support services. Learn more at gtc.edu.
Here's what the weather looks like today. A winter storm warning is in effect for Douglas, Bayfield, 3 inches of snow, and some ice glaze. Rain and fog in the south, then becoming mostly sunny with highs in the 40s. It's 8:21 now.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on helping organizations adapt to change and prepare for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. From MGM with Licorice Pizza, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, about the navigation of first love. Starring Alana Haim, Cooper Hoffman, Sean Penn, and Bradley Cooper. Now in select theaters, everywhere Christmas. And from Heifer International, where people can discover animal matches and gifts.
As an overwhelming number of characters in children's media have historically all. We reported on those studies, and today we bring you recommendations. NPR's Elizabeth Blair asked children's media experts to tell us about recent kids' entertainment that gets high marks for both storytelling and inclusion.
Princess Dajrai Johnson is a member of the Nitsai Gutchen, indigenous peoples in Alaska. She's also a writer and producer on the PBS show Molly from Denali. One of her recommendations is the new Netflix series City of Ghosts.
I just love how it relates so deeply to place.
A group of kids in Los Angeles learns about the city's history by talking to the ghosts of people who lived in different neighborhoods.
It was a few weeks ago, a voice. I looked around, but there was nobody there.
In one episode, a member of the Ghost Club hears a voice whenever he visits a park near the river. For research, the kids talk to members of the indigenous Tongva. One of them translates what the voice is saying.
Every pebble, a planet. Every stone, a grave.
So the story is a window, and sometimes it's a mirror, says Mariana Diaz-Vioncek, a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant for children's media.
The shows that are, and characters that resonate the most are actually both. You see yourself reflected in them, but you also get to learn about other things.
Diaz-Vioncek spent several years as head of education and research for Dora the Explorer. Today, she's a consultant on the new show, Alma's Way.
Beaming with pride and something to say. Hear those drums playing Alma's Way.
Created by Sonia Manzano of Sesame Street fame, Alma is a Puerto Rican girl from the Bronx. Her friends are of different races, ethnicities, and abilities. But they also face kid-sized challenges you might find anywhere.
I hate to say it, but our clubhouse is kind of plain.
Yeah, too cardboardy.
Totally. The first mission of the Cardboard Club should be to decorate our clubhouse.
Alma's Way was recommended by Rutgers professor Amy Jordan, who co-edits the Journal of Children and Media.
The colors pop, the characters are vivid. It's just a really well-done program.
Diaz-Vioncek says Alma's open and welcoming attitude was intentional.
It matters more how we represent a community that supports all people than how we represent each individual. So you have that respect.
Grandmother to school for Grandparents' Day, but she's afraid the traditional tribal markings on her face will frighten her classmates. It happened once before.
On their way home, a little boy pointed at Nana, and Zura heard him say to his mother, "That lady looks scary."
I think all kids will resonate with Zura's fears of being different.
Deborah Pope is the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation. In the story, Nana Akua does go to Zora's school for Grandparents' Day.
And I brought some special makeup so that each of you can have beautiful African symbols on your face, too.
Her grandmother just aces the situation by showing how she can make differences familiar and therefore bridge the cultural gap.
Embracing your culture, your personality, and your dreams is at the heart of our next recommendation for diverse children's media, the picture book, The Me I Choose to Be, written by Natasha Tarp.
Here's what you must understand. My creativity and curiosity flow without end, and if I meet an obstacle, I just begin again.
Each page of this book is a wildly imaginative photograph of a different child of color. A majestic girl in a silver dress looks to the sky, holding a fiery planet in her hand. A ballerina dances across a luminous violet night sky.
The images are just amazing.
The Me I Choose to Be is recommended by Kevin Clark, a former professor at George Mason University's College of Education and Human Development. He says the photography by Regis and Karen Bethencourt will inspire kids.
They're uplifting, they're bright, they're vibrant, they're unlike anything I've ever seen in a children's picture book.
Kevin Clark has been working in the children's media space for more than 20 years. He's watched the evolution of efforts to make kids' content more diverse, and he's seen some strides. But he says there needs to be more people of color at every level of the process, from creation to finance and marketing.
People are having to justify or to present books in a way that so that other people can understand it and be connected to it, and then they'll free up the resources to be able to get it out to a wider audience. So I think having more people in these rooms and in positions of power to make these decisions can also be helpful.
With nearly half of all people under 18, people of color, content creators might want to see diversity as more than an afterthought. For more recommendations of diverse children's media, check out the NPR website at npr.org. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
John Wilson spends his days walking around New York City with a camera, capturing what many of us might miss. In his HBO show, How To with John Wilson, he unveils the absurdity of the mundane.
I really want the show to capture a New York that feels like both timeless, but also aggressively dated at times.
This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on WPR, and the latest news is just ahead, including the details of this story. Wisconsin's winter road maintenance costs have dropped.
Businesses are affected. Employers that allow unvaccinated workers at offices or job sites can be fined. For weeks, New York City has been tightening vaccine rules. De Blasio says one goal is to avoid lockdowns, school closures, and other quarantine measures. All New Yorkers over the age of 5 now must show proof of vaccination in order to eat inside at a restaurant, work out at a gym, or attend most public gatherings or entertainment spaces. This comes as Omicron-related COVID cases continue to surge across New York State, with more than 36,000 new infections reported on Sunday alone, and the number of people hospitalized continuing to rise. Brian Mann, NPR News.
Decades amid efforts to reduce salt pollution. Danielle Kading has more.
Winter maintenance costs on the state highway system dropped from more than $111 million to $74 million over the last three winters. The state has seen lower costs as it cut overall salt use to less than 325,000 tons last year. James Hughes with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation says that's the least amount of salt used in two decades.
In a world where everything's going up in price, our winter maintenance costs in Wisconsin are going down. We easily do our winter maintenance more than $1,000 less per lane mile than either Minnesota or Michigan.
The state has been cutting back on road salt as groups have pushed to limit its use to protect the environment. Around 50 counties are transitioning to using more brine and less road salt without compromising safety. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Construction is ahead of schedule at the Mulva Cultural Center in De Pere. The $95 million facility will feature a large exhibition hall, a cinema, sculpture gardens, and a restaurant. It's expected to host more than a dozen traveling exhibits each year. CEO Mike Van Asten says it'll be the first complex of its kind in the region, attracting exhibits that normally go to Milwaukee, Chicago, and Minneapolis. The facility is planned to open in 2023, and it's designed by famed architecture firm Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill.
This is the first time that they've got a building this far north in Wisconsin. So I've had groups already call me asking for tours of the building just because it's an SOM building.
SOM is in the 40s. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Find more at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Klaviyo, working to help brands deliver personalized email and SMS campaigns that drive revenue and create genuine customer relationships at klaviyo.com/NPR. And from C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is Enterprise AI.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Ilya Marritz join us now for a look ahead. Andrew, let's start with you. In the last year, Trump's company and its chief financial officer were charged with a 15-year scheme to defraud taxpayers. The former president had to testify under oath in a civil lawsuit. So what do we know about what's coming in 2022?
There are so many investigations and cases, both civil and criminal, that authorities overvaluing or undervaluing his properties, depending on which made him the most money. Then there are lawsuits around abuse of power. That is bucket two. The third and the last bucket involves Trump allegedly condoning or all these cases and investigations are different state
jury starting soon. The crux of this case, which was charged last July, is that the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer engaged in a conspiracy to cheat tax authorities out of millions of dollars over a decade and a half. And there could be more. He expects more indictments. A sign of how advanced this investigation is, it was reported that Trump's banker and accountant were speaking to investigators just this month.
The prosecutor in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance Jr., is leaving office. What does that mean for the criminal case?
Well, the case will continue under Vance's successor. His name is Alvin Bragg. Bragg hasn't said much publicly about the case, but one point on his resume is that he earlier worked in the New York Attorney General's office, where he was involved in an earlier civil suit against Trump's family foundation. In the end, the foundation was dissolved. The Trump family were banned from taking leadership roles in New York charities. So Alvin Bragg, the new DA, is someone who has experience dealing with Trump in court.
All right, so that's bucket one, business. What about abuse of power?
So a local prosecutor in Georgia, Fonnie Willis, is looking into whether Trump broke the law when he tried to get Georgia officials to overturn the vote there. You might remember a recording of a phone call that was released at the very beginning of this year, where Trump was urging the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to find at least 11,779 votes for Trump, exactly enough to have him edge out the actual winner in Georgia, Joe Biden.
All right, so there are criminal and civil probes involving fraud and abuse of power, Andrea, then a whole bunch of civil cases involving the attack on the Capitol.
There really is a pileup of cases in this area. There are two separate lawsuits brought by members of Congress and two other ones involving groups of police officers. They're suing some combination of the former president, his former attorney, Rudy Giuliani, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers. And all of them rely on a little-used law, the KKK Act of 1871. This law allows plaintiffs to sue for civil damages when they say there's a conspiracy to prevent federal officers from carrying out their duties using threats or violence. Next month, there's a hearing set in federal court in Washington, D.C., and then after that, a judge will decide if these lawsuits can proceed to the discovery phase.
And, you know, there's one more case involving violence that is slated for trial in May. This one is from before Trump was president. The allegation is that Donald Trump, quote, authorized and approved an assault by his own bodyguards against a group of protesters outside Trump Tower in 2015. It's a civil suit. Trump already gave video testimony under oath this past fall, and that testimony is expected to be part of the trial in the spring.
Ilya, we've been paying attention to Trump associates caught in the January 6th inquiry, but that's not the only legal headache for people close to the former president.
No. Last April, the FBI sought the candidacy of Joe Biden. So prosecutors are now in possession of thousands and thousands of electors.
There really hasn't been a deep legal reckoning for the former president, the businessman, in a court of law. As of now, he and his company face actual trials next year for their business practices. And there's a process of truth-telling that occurs in a trial, one that is very different from the back and forth of politics. We learn things, and we could learn a lot more about Trump's business at the very same time that voters are making decisions at the polls.
That's NPR's Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Marritz. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
About drawing strength from failure in her new children's book called Stacy's Extraordinary Words.
One of the benefits of having an IRA is that you can take your required minimum distribution in the form of a gift to Wisconsin Public Radio. The IRA charitable rollover is a convenient and tax-free way to support the news, information, and music you rely on each day. Or visit WPR.org/support to learn more. Make a difference today. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from My Choice Wisconsin, committed to the well-being of elderly and disabled adults, providing Medicaid and Medicare programs promoting independence, diversity.
Page. This is Morning Edition on WPR. Here's some of what's happening in the news today. Edward O. Wilson, the pioneering Harvard biologist who argued for a new vision of human nature in sociobiology and warned against the decline of ecosystems, has died. He was 92. A tribute posted Monday on the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation's website said Wilson died on December 26th. The professor won two Pulitzer Prizes, including one for the lavishly illustrated book The Ants, showcasing the insects whose behavior he studied for decades. Defense attorneys have sought to dismiss the indictment against five men accused of plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
Financial consultant. Schwab works to make it easy to plan for tomorrow, today. More at schwab.com/plan. From Noom, a personalized weight loss program designed to give people knowledge to set new goals and the tools to stick to them for good. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. While the game industry was hobbled by an ongoing pandemic, video games themselves provided fun and sanity in a year when both were in short supply. NPR surveyed staff and contributors for their favorite games of 2021, and the results are diverse, ranging from the cozy to the scary. NPR's James Mastromarino oversaw the final list, which you can read right now at NPR.org. James, let's talk about some of the highlights. NPR staffers focused in on about 20 games in particular, but we're going to talk about the most nominated. And it all starts with It Takes Two. What was so special about this one?
Well, It Takes Two, just like the name would say, you can't play it alone. You have to have a real human partner with you playing alongside, either online or right next to you. The story is just wild. You play a couple who wants to get a divorce. Their daughter is understandably distraught by this. She cries on some dolls, does some magic accidentally, transports you into the bodies of these dolls.
I told you they'd come in handy.
I love them.
Spin away.
This happens to be our most nominated. Some catharsis in horror. And this series has been long running. It started as like a zombie survival game, but it's really mutated in the decades since. And Resident Evil Village puts you in a snowy town, isolated somewhere in Europe, and before Lady Dimitrescu.
You escaped my little brother's idiot games, did you? Let's see how special you are.
Our reviewer, Louis McKelly, described Resident Evil Village as a perfect ease into the series. It's scary, it's goofy, an absolute thrill ride, and it's gorgeous to look at.
You know what they always say, James? It takes a Resident Evil Village to entertain a gamer. At least that's what
right.
I've heard. All right, now finally, I see there's this other game, Life is Strange.
It's in an accident, and she begins to investigate the mysterious circumstances surrounding that. Oh, and I should mention, she's got these empathic superpowers that manifest as colorful auras around the people she sees.
I know what other people are feeling, and if they feel strongly enough, if they're angry or sad or afraid, I feel it too, and then I lose control.
All that... Our contributor, Brittany Vincent, had the last word here. She said, from its gripping story to its realistic portrayals of trauma and human relationships, Life is Strange, True Colors is a masterful exercise in storytelling that you'll not soon forget. And that can be said of a lot of games on this list. Many found playful ways to take difficult themes head on, and I think we're only going to see more of this as games respond to the difficult years we've all been having, just as other media do.
That's NPR's James Mastromarino. He surveyed NPR staff for their favorite video games of the year, and you can read more about them at NPR.org. James, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is December 27th, starting at noon.
Douglas, Bayfield, Murnett, Washburn, and Sawyer counties until tonight, with additional snow accumulations up to 5 inches, plus some ice. A winter weather advisory is in effect until 10 this morning for the rest of northern and central Wisconsin, with 1 to 3 inches of snow and some ice. Rain and fog in the south today, then becoming mostly sunny with highs in the 40s. Wintry mix and snow for the rest of the state with highs in the 30s. And on Tuesday, more snow likely across the state, possibly mixed with rain and...
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Georgia's Stacey Abrams is again. Her book is called Stacey's Extraordinary Words, and it's about her spelling bee prowess. She told Rachel Martin that back then, her mom encouraged her during competitions, and she did so again when she narrowly lost a bid for governor in 2018.
I didn't think about stopping for very long, but that there was a 10-day period between Election Day and my speech ending the campaign when I really thought about whether politics was for me, because it was a very... It was a very tough 2 weeks. And one of the conversations with my mom was about how do you keep going? How do you face the kind of public loss that I'd faced and show your face again? And both she and my dad were very adamant that if I chose to do it again or not, that it should be a choice made because of what I wanted, not because of what happened.
How did you separate the two? Because losing in and of itself can be a powerful motivator for good.
Part of the story in the book, and certainly part of my story, was going back to why I ran in the first place. I ran because I thought this would be a platform that would allow me to serve a greater number of people. And the issue and the resolution of my tensions was that if I ran because I wanted a title, then yes, I'd lost and I should stop. But if I ran because I wanted to do work, my responsibility was to figure out how to do that work without those titles. And certainly it's not the same work, but there is still work to be done.
Georgia was one of the states where Donald Trump didn't just contest the election results in 2020, but he tried to pressure the state's top election official, Brad Raffensperger, to change the results in his favor, a direct usurpation of American democracy. Is Georgia's electoral system stronger because it survived that pressure or weaker because it came so close?
Our electoral system survived because we followed the intent of democracy, and it is weaker now because the very same people who defended it against the assault of January 6th capitulated in weeks past by passing laws that weaken access, that subvert democracy. Unfortunately, Georgia has a weakened electoral system, and we need federal action to shore it up and return it to the posture that we should all expect, which is one where every eligible voter has the ease of access that they deserve.
Lots of activists on the left, especially Black Democrats, feel President Biden just hasn't done enough to deliver for a group of voters that delivered for him. And they are worried it's going to be tough to get people motivated next November. Do you share that concern?
Every election is a call to action. Voting is medicine. And it is an act of obligation that we have to engage in every single time at every level. My intention is to run a campaign and to work with Senator Raphael Warnock to remind Georgia voters of what has happened, that we have a commander-in-chief who takes COVID seriously and has poured billions of dollars into our state to help us withstand its effects, even though our state government has failed to fully deploy those dollars, that we have a vaccine that is available, and we have to do the work of overcoming hesitancy and suspicion to ensure that as many people in our state get the help they need, that we have resources that have lifted children out of poverty. They will turn out again, and they will understand that we are building towards a future, but the future doesn't happen all at once.
I mean, you believe your message is strong and you've connected with voters throughout the past 3 years. Is it just a matter of getting your voters
to persuade people that it's worth staying engaged? But that's work I'm happy to do. I'm the daughter of two pastors who before that were civil rights activists and were always through my life civil justice warriors and social justice warriors. And what they taught me is that you meet people where they are, not what they say or will do their best to make it so. And going back to Stacey's extraordinary words, part of the story is about the fact that we're never going to do everything we should, but that does not absolve us of the obligation to try. Stacy didn't speak up when she thought she should, but she committed herself to trying again and trying again. And I'm going to keep trying again because I believe that we have a state that could be extraordinary if we invested in our people. And I'm going to spend the next year talking to Georgians and telling them about that vision, but listening to how they think that vision can be made real.
Stacey Abrams, Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia and the author of the new children's book, Stacey's Extraordinary Words. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate the time.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Melissa.
In the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.